we have Professor Charles House, who holds degrees from Nebraska and Princeton, and is nearing that stage when he'll have a final terminal degree from Michigan State. His experience, which permits him to appear in front of this group with the title of authoritative title, is the fact that he has had several experiences over a period of years in West Africa in particular. His first experience being as team leader for Operations Crossroads Africa, spending most of his time in 1962 in Western Nigeria. Then he was West Africa representative for Crossroads Africa in 1963 and spending most of his time in the West and the North and other West African countries. Then some of the members of the class here and I were fortunate enough to be assigned to the University of Nigeria project in the summer of 1964, and in this team was Professor Charles House, his wife, and his five boys, who also lived across the street from me on the campus. His title there was advisor in the humanities, and this is, as you probably remember, we had a team of 28 members out there working in all of the departments on the campus in varying capacities, some of us serving as administrators, some as administrators and advisors, some teaching, and combination of events. He also had involvement with the two MINEX teams, and I don't really know what the MINEX was, but we had visiting groups of students coming from Michigan State to spend the summer at the University of Nigeria. And they were learning, they were taking, I think, 9 hours of credit courses in things which they could only obtain in this area. At the same time, we had a Nigerian team of students coming to Michigan State for the similar period of time and taking work here. And so he had considerable involvement there at the cross-cultural, bicultural student levels. He also served on the participant training selection team to select those most qualified Nigerian students that ought to be sent for further training in the United States or West Germany or England, wherever they could get the best training, to come back and to assume their role in the university so that the team could come home and leave the job there to the Nigerians. As you all know, we didn't reach that point quite, but we were well on our way when other things happened. Any other questions about these experiences that you want to raise, you can raise them of him. But at this time, I will present to you Professor Charles House, who will give you, I'm sure, some very interesting insights into the culture of Nigeria and West Africa. Charles?
Someone is likely to tell this story again, but I think I have more license to tell it than anyone else. One day, not too long after we'd taken up residence on the campus of the University of Nigeria at Nsukka, a tradesman came to our door and he said, "Can you tell me the name of the man who lives in that house over there?" And I said, "Why, yes, that's Dr. Bushman's house." And he looked at me most peculiarly, and he said, one way or another, "Are you sure that that is his name?" And I said, "Yes, I'm sure that it is his name." And he sort of snickered and shook his head. And the reason for his response was that Bushman is a term of great opprobrium among the people of the locality, and it has reference to an uncultured and primitive person, and if you want to call somebody a bad name, you call him a Bushman. this is something that Mel had to live with all the time that he was there. And really, the fact that to be called a bushman is a term of opprobrium has something to do with what I want to talk with you about this evening. Before I do, however, there's a comment I want to make. I'm sure that each speaker that's going to face this group, or who has faced it, has either implicitly or explicitly had something to say about the attitude with which we approach the subject of the Nigerian Biafra conflict. It's impossible for me personally to forget that we're talking about people. We're talking about millions of people whose lives and hopes are totally wrapped up in the struggle which is taking place there right now. And millions more who are not directly touched are going to be involved in its implications, particularly so since the effect of what has happened in Nigeria will be felt all across the African continent and beyond, and I'm sure you're as aware of that as I am. Furthermore, I personally am committed enough to a belief in the essential oneness of the human race that I feel that what's now happening between the Niger and Cross Rivers has something to do with me personally. And this would be true regardless of the fact that I had the privilege of living there for a short time. It's my plea then at the outset, as it is the condition which I've tried to set for myself in preparing what I have to say, that we be as objective as possible, but objective with the recognition that we're talking about human lives and human hopes. We don't treat this kind of thing casually. And with that, I want to move on to the substance of what I have to say. Before I do, however, I should warn you. I'm a little bit frightened by the subject, religious and cultural implications of the Nigeria-Biafra conflict. It seems to me that this is a subject which might more properly fall to an anthropologist, ethnologist, sociologist, which I am not. I've taken a little different tack than what you might expect. And we have the second hour if you want to expand on subjects which are of more direct interest to you, fine. But I'm going to try to deal with something which is rooted in culture, which is rooted in religion, and which I think is basic to the problem that they're having there right now. Differences in tribal culture and religion are ingredients in the antagonism which has led to war in Nigeria. But their effect is of a somewhat different order than we might suppose. It's more than a simple matter of ethnic chauvinism. African cultures in general are remarkably tolerant. It seems to be a prevailing attitude that the customs and beliefs of any group are that group's own business, and no stranger has a right to interfere. I've heard Nigerians speak disparagingly about beliefs and practices of ethnic groups other than their own, but there was never any suggestion that those people should be either encouraged or forced to do otherwise. It's the Europeans, if we examine ourselves, it is the Europeans who go out to war in defense of the true faith and the protection and promotion of civilization. The African viewpoint is phrased by Chinua Achebe in his novel Things Fall Apart, which I'd recommend as a resource for your discussion here. Sometimes it's the novelists who come through with greater clarity than the discursive scholars. This book and its companion, No Longer at Ease. In Things Fall Apart, one of the characters says, "It is not our custom to fight for our gods. If a man kills the sacred python in the secrecy of his hut, the matter lies between him and the god. We did not see it. If we put ourselves between the God and his victim, we may receive blows intended for the offender. When a man blasphemes, what do we do? Do we go out and stop his mouth? No. We put our fingers in our ears to stop us hearing. This is the basic tolerance of African civilizations. Beyond this, the customs and the traditions of the various tribal communities represent a morality which, until it was ruptured by the impact of European values, managed to maintain order and stability in African societies. This is not to say that conflict didn't exist, but the indigenous systems provided humane means of resolving those conflicts. There was an authority of custom and tradition supporting codes of personal and community morality. There was the mask, or there was the secret society, articulating the counsel and admonition of the ancestors. There was the shrine or the oracle to which oaths could be sworn in particular issues. Where such a system was followed, a person accused of a crime could go to a shrine, a particular shrine, make a sacrifice and take an oath of innocence. And if he were in fact innocent, nothing would happen. But if his oath were false, it was firmly believed that he would die within a stipulated period of time. This is a belief peculiar to one ethnic group, but with its counterparts among others. No one would take an oath of that kind lightly. The same sort of system could be used in settling issues between litigants. In some places, there were secret societies whose function was to go at night to the house of someone who was known to have violated the traditional moral codes or who was suspected of moral misconduct. And there, the members of the society would sing songs of admonition and counsel him in that way to mend his ways. These seem to me to be remarkably gentle ways of preserving order in communities. And then always there was the respect for the moral authority of elders and respect for the judgment of elders as they sat in council. Now, I've been speaking of these social controls in the past tense. Although there are still many places, and some of you know those places, which are as yet relatively untouched by foreign values, and where these controls still function. Then again, for most Africans, particularly most Nigerians, tradition and custom have some moral force for everybody. Although in some places the effectiveness of this force has been vitiated by the advent of Western civilization and the Christian religion. The point is that indigenous African customs and traditions have provided a functional system of personal morality and of social control. In spite of some particular customs which to the Western mind seem strange and barbaric, the overall intention and effect of these customs was humane and civilized. It's possible, of course, to romanticize the traditional African cultures out of all relationship to reality. Change is necessary if Africans are to enjoy the benefits of economic development. But one cannot help but regret that things of beauty and things of worth must perish along with that which is old and ugly. Let me make one more point in connection with this positive value of indigenous traditions. it is to the kinship group and the tribe that the African owes his sense of personal identity. I'm using African in a rather broad sense here. I know that an ethnologist would counsel you and would counsel me that there are a great variety of African cultures and African indigenous traditions. But I use African advisedly there because this seems to be one of those common points which unites most, if not all, of the various cultures of Africa. And among them, it is to the kinship group and to the tribe that the individual owes his sense of personal identity. It's the tribe and the clan which give meaning to individual human existence. It's been suggested that in the intensely communal society, the individual counts for little. And so it might seem to us, sitting here and looking at it from the standpoint of our own culture. But I think to believe that is to misunderstand it. It is rather that the individual is fulfilled by his participation in the larger life of his people. Europeans tend to look at it the other way around. They see the social group as existing for the benefit of the individual. Africans tend to see the individual existing for the benefit of the social group. This sometimes has resulted in customs and practices which seem to violate the value of human life. In some places, if the birth of twins was regarded as an abomination which threatened the well-being of the whole life of the people, and it was felt to be necessary to placate offended gods, twins might have been killed. They were. Or if in time of misfortune it was felt that the gods ought to be satisfied by the sacrifice of a human victim, sometimes this was done. But it was always in the interest of preserving the total life of the people. These customs, happily, are extinct in Nigeria, but they serve to illustrate the idea that the prime value is the preservation of the tribe and the preservation of the integrity of the kinship group. Today we find families, villages, tribal unions making financial sacrifices and dear ones in order that their most talented young people may have the benefits of education. But this is done with the expectation that the beneficiaries are going to come back and add their prestige and their achievement and their increased earning capacity to the group which has sponsored them. The identity and the sense of belonging which the kinship group or extended family provides has a kind of metaphysical dimension as well. Not only does the family include living generations, there's also a sense of continuity with past generations. The past generations being represented, of course, by the ancestors. And there's also a sense of continuity with unborn generations, as the ancestors, according to indigenous belief, continue to be reincarnated with the birth of children. You can look at any number of ethnic groups in Nigeria, and when you learn what names mean, you can see how often the name given to a child will mean, my father lives. My father lives, you see, in this child which has been born. Or similar names expressing the idea that the continuity is taking place. Perhaps it's expressed even more pointedly in the poem by Birago Diop, who is Senegalese. But the concept is certainly applicable to most of the Nigerian tribal cultures. This is what Diop says. Listen more often to things rather than beings. Hear the fire's voice. Hear the voice of water. In the wind, hear the sobbing of the trees. It is our forefathers breathing. The dead are not gone forever. They are in the paling shadows and in the darkening shadows. The dead are not beneath the ground. They are in the rustling tree, in the murmuring wood, in the still water, in the flowing water, in the lonely place, in the crowd. The dead are not dead. It is this sense of continuity with former generations which further serves to reinforce the feeling of unity and identity in the family and tribe, and it's built into the consciousness of every member of such groups. This, then, is the tragic ambiguity of tribalism in Nigeria and Biafra. On one hand, it represents this system which incorporates morality, dignity, and value. The system which provides for the individual a sense of identity, of purpose, and of personal worth. On the other hand, these self-same identities have become the focus of suspicion, of hatred, and finally of wholesale bloodshed. Along with bribery, nepotism, and corruption, tribalism has become one of the four horsemen of Nigeria's modern apocalypse. Those of you who have had the benefit of Nigerian journalism and Nigerian political oratory recognize that allusion, because no expression of a political nature is complete without a kind of ritual condemnation of bribery, nepotism, corruption, and tribalism. These are the things which there a politician must necessarily oppose in public. Dr. Okechukwu Ikejiani, at one time the pro-chancellor and chairman of the council of the University of Ibadan, put his finger, I think, on the heart of the problem when he wrote, and I quote, "A society like an individual can get out of touch with itself. It makes sense or not depending on what it is and what it thinks it is and what it wants to be. In a generation of change so rapid and profound that the pace cannot be appreciated, Nigeria's picture of itself has gone out of focus." Dr. Ikejiani wrote those sentences about 4 years ago. It is now plain the extent to which Nigeria's and now Biafra's images of themselves have become blurred. He might well have gone on to say that the national identities are out of focus precisely because the individuals who make up the society have somehow lost sight of who they are. And this is the real religious and cultural factor in the problem as I see it. The displacement of identities and values has come about in consequence of this almost incomprehensible rate of economic and social change which has taken place, particularly during and following the Second World War. It's a natural product of the impact of Western values and Western techniques on the indigenous culture, as Nigerians have been caught up in the race for economic development. The techniques of European industry, the methods of European business administration, a European philosophy of education, all of them features of this development process, have conspired to undermine the traditional culture. Now let's face it, some of the aspects of that culture had to go in order to accommodate necessary changes and improvements in the conditions of life. But what has happened is that the baby has gone out with the bath. Moral and social values have been uprooted with no functional systems to replace them. And the result has been a kind of moral vacuum. There are areas which are relatively untouched by the changes which have taken place, and there the traditional moralities continue to function. But in the cities and the towns, in the market centers, to which so many people have been flocking, which are the centers of politics and decision making, in these places, this lack is most significantly felt. This is more than simply the encounter of new ideas and new ways of doing things, which are only partly understood. It's also the speed and the manner in which the encounter between African civilization and European civilization has taken place. For all practical purposes, the encounters began with the slave trade. And that's a tragic way in which to open up any new relationship. The primary effects of slavery were horrible enough. Perhaps Dr. Hooker told you about this. The carrying off of thousands of human beings by naked force and carrying them into a kind of existence which reduced them to the level of animals. It reduced them to that level, that is, if they survived. The secondary effects were, if anything, more devastating. The trade in slaves suborned the native morality. It incited some groups to aggression against their neighbors for the purpose of capturing slaves for sale. Perhaps they had no choice. The life of a stranger in the communal society was less valuable than the life of a kinsman. So the lesser of evils was to raid a neighboring tribe for slaves rather than to see a brother carried off. While the slave trade centered at the coast, this secondary effect was felt far, far inland. Slavery was nothing new to the peoples of Nigeria. But here again, indigenous slavery seems always to have recognized the basic humanity of the slave. Even when he was sacrificed, as he occasionally was, it was because it was necessary to offer a human being as the most valuable object that could be offered. As barbaric as this seems to you and me, it was more humane in its social context than was this reduction of man to the status of a beast of burden, which was characteristic of European slave trading. The slave trade was a harsh introduction of the African to European civilization. It emphasized the single element of power as being the distinction between the white man's culture and that of the black. Helpless in the face of firearms, the African took what seemed to him to be the next best course. He sought ways of tapping the white man's power for himself on the basis of this well-known theory that if you can't beat him, join him. The next large-scale encounter of the African with the civilization of Europe was the missionary movement of the 19th century. The missionaries came for quite different reasons than the slavers had come. But as far as the African was concerned, it was exceedingly difficult to separate one from the other. They were both a part of the same system. And so the white man's religion was seen as one more aspect of the white man's power. And this really made excellent sense to the African, whose own religion was so profoundly concerned with the achievement and the preservation of personal potency. The missionaries did little to correct that impression. The upshot of the process was that gradually Christianity became grafted on to pre-existing structures of belief. And the combination was often a strange one. Often, too, the customs and the rituals which gave shape to indigenous life were condemned out of hand as paganism, and converts were led to disparage their own traditions. And this is not something that happened in the distant past either. In some places and in some cases, that attitude is still maintained. That anything having to do with the traditional belief, the traditional practice, the traditional social forms is an evidence of paganism and ought to go with conversion to Christianity. The result was a divided belief and a divided morality. The superficial aspects of Christianity were imitated, but without this supporting understanding of essential beliefs and essential ethical concepts. There couldn't be such a genuine understanding, because Christianity, in its institutional European forms, in the forms in which it came to Africa, with people who certainly were most well-meaning, they were heroes. They came at tremendous sacrifice to themselves. In the early days of the missionary movement, the life expectancy of a European missionary in the rainforest areas was 6 months, a year. They came and knew that the minute they set foot on the continent, they were dying men, and still they came. And so we can't disparage them too much. But they carried with them the attitudes which prevailed in 19th century Europe. And this was that Europeans were civilized and Africans were uncivilized. And they simply weren't prepared to look about them and see that they had moved into the midst of a system which had its own functioning and dignified system of belief. One wishes that somebody had taken the time to sit down and look and listen and learn before he began to open his mouth. But then again, they had so little time. And some of them did make the change, but they were a tragic few. Thus, the effect of the acceptance of Christianity was, in its overall effects, demoralizing. Excused by his new faith from observing the traditional moral sanctions, the convert had no really effective moral principle to put in its place. For the majority of Christian converts, even today, the process is one of trying to observe a double standard of indigenous morality on the one hand and Christian practice on the other. And the result is a kind of forced hypocrisy. Perhaps the most prominent example, the one most discussed, is the issue of polygyny or polygamy. The missionaries, seeing a plural marriage through Western eyes, automatically labeled it sin. And they condemned it as such, even though it was a functional part of the social systems that existed, and that still exist for that matter. The result is that we saw, and we still occasionally see, the Christian with an official wife to whom he is married in the eyes of the church and the law, and yet at the same time living with other wives which are recognized only by native tradition. Such a person in the midst of the Christian community must be conscious that he's acting out a hypocrisy. And in his traditional community, he's prevented in some ways from fulfilling completely his responsibilities to his polygynous household. Most of them, I think we have to say, make the compromises rather well. But it's one more ingredient in this total cultural confusion. A man or a woman is forced to live in two worlds, two quite different worlds, and his own identity tends to get lost someplace between. Sylvia Leith Ross, in her old but still good book, African Women, has this paragraph, and I would add this to your growing bibliography. Sylvia Leith Ross was asked by the British administration to come to eastern Nigeria after the riot of market women in Aba in 1921. And her book dates back to the mid-20s. But she still has one of the most valuable, accurate, objective, and sympathetic insights into the nature of that culture that anyone has produced. That's Sylvia Leith Ross, L-I-E-T-H hyphen R-O-S-S. And she says this about the missionary effort. Were it not for the hope that grace is at work in ways unseen, one would often be ready to say that mission work was a failure. This is a hackneyed phrase which one hesitates to repeat, connoting as it does either a personal prejudice against Christianity itself, a sentimental view of the virtues of the untouched savage, or the too ready acceptance of one-sided information. But in my case, whenever I have been inclined to make this statement, it has been the result not of conversations with a diehard pagan, nor of what I might have heard from a malicious backslider, but of seeing and hearing the devout church member or well-meaning catechumen. Fortunately, the church, under pressure from a new generation of African Christians, as well as from a new kind of missionary, is aware of the situation and is modifying its approach. But one must wonder if it is not already too late. We can only hope that it isn't. Another aspect of the missionary effort has not yet been mentioned, and this is education. This is the area in which missionaries have made their deepest impact. While it is to missionary education that Nigeria certainly owes the base of clerical and technological talent which has made possible her 20th century economic development, this education, too, has contributed to the cultural ambiguity which has threatened, at least for some Nigerians, to thrust them right back to the beginning. The model for missionary education was the British public school. It is, for instance, only within the last 5 years, and you can correct me on that, Tosho, if I'm incorrect, that it's only within the last 5 years that Nigerian history has replaced British constitutional history as a requirement in the school certificate examinations, the examinations which are required for admission to university. The aim has been to produce what Tai Sholaran, the energetic principal of one of Nigeria's first non-missionary private schools, calls a black gentleman in white collars. Again, the dilemma for the educated Nigerian is whether he is an African or whether he's a black European. Raised in the tradition of his people, and then steeped in the attitudes of the West, gaining a real sense of reverence for Western values through an education which may have taken him all the way up to the PhD level. These educated people are caught in a whipsaw between two worlds. Chinua Achebe, the one I mentioned earlier, is a novelist who has passed through this experience and he has felt its ambiguities. The very titles of his book tell the story. The two companion volumes, he's written more than these, but the two which fit so neatly together are his novels Things Fall Apart and No Longer at Ease. These trace with remarkable insight the tragic condition of the educated man who is trapped between the rival claims of his traditional system and the new values which he has absorbed. It isn't that it's a conflict, you see, of good with bad, or even of old with new. It is a conflict between two competing goods. And this is the essence of tragedy. And furthermore, it's different from classical tragedy. As a matter of fact, in one of these novels, Achebe has a paragraph on tragedy, what it is. He's a young Nigerian who has studied English in a British university, comes back, and he's being interviewed before a selection board for a government appointment. And there is a literary gentleman on the selection committee who asks him something about literary theory, and he says that tragedy, as he sees it, is a little different from the classical tragedy in which the hero dies and the emotions are purged and we all feel good again. He said, real tragedy to me is the kind of thing where a man is caught and must go on and on and on without any resolution to it. And one cannot help but feel when Achebe wrote that paragraph that he had some reference to his own position and those of his counterparts. I'm supposed to be talking about the cultural and religious elements in the Nigeria-Biafra conflict. The major point which I've been trying to make is that at the very root of things, the problem which has produced the conflict is a moral problem. And it's much deeper than simply the cultural differences between ethnic groups. It's the problem of a society and a group of societies which have lost their perspective on who they are and what they are. As Ikejiani says, things have gone out of focus. Any society or any individual who has no place to turn for a source of value, no place to turn for moral authority, is going to disintegrate. And the result is very likely to be the kind of irrational violence which we have seen in Nigeria. And again, let's face it, let's not be so busy looking abroad that we can't see that very much the same kind of thing threatens us here as well. And for the same reason, this radical displacement of values and the loss of individual identities that go along with it. Robertson Smith is, I think, a great historian of religion. And he began his book, The Religion of the Semites, with these words: "No positive religion that has moved man has been able to start with a tabula rasa and express itself as if religion were beginning for the first time. In form, if not in substance, the new system must be in contact all along the line with the older ideas and practices which it finds in its possession. A new scheme of faith can find a hearing only by appealing to religious instincts and susceptibilities that already exist. And it cannot reach these, and this is the important thing, it cannot reach these without taking account of the traditional forms in which all religious feeling is embodied, and without speaking a language which men accustomed to these old forms can understand. Christianity began in Nigeria with a radical disjunction from the old forms, and consequently, what roots it has been able to establish are shallow ones. The same thing, I think, could be said of most of the institutions inherited from Europe, which do not build on this pre-existing traditional foundation. Western concepts of law, for instance. At the heart of the Western concept of law, we have the idea of individual rights. And it's founded on an abstract, impersonal idea of justice. Justice as an absolute. Now, these concepts of law become little more than legalism, or they can degenerate into legalism, litigiousness, in a society which carries this highly personal and highly situational concept of custom. Societies in which the integrity of the social group, as we said before, remains more important than the individual. And along with the concepts of law, political forms likewise need to grow out of the deep-running traditional values which are still present in the Nigerian consciousness. Forms, political forms, which represent the total frame of thought of the people whom they are intended to govern. Aside from this, the business of operating a parliamentary democracy is a bit like operating a machine that we don't really understand. We may be able to operate the mechanism, the control board, but if something goes wrong, there's no way to set it right again. Because fundamentally it's not understood, and fundamentally it doesn't relate to the real situation in which it's supposed to function. When such functional political systems do emerge in Nigeria and in Africa, they may not bear much resemblance to American constitutional or British parliamentary democracy. And this very well may alarm and shock us. It may cause some senators to look again with askance at the foreign aid budget. But I think we have to be prepared to accept these kinds of forms. I'm confident that given time and a measure of tranquility, in all of these social institutions, the necessary social institutions, functional, indigenous, that is to say, forms which are related to the indigenous bases of life, are going to emerge in all of the different necessary social institutions. And they're going to be compatible with both the demands of the modern age and the basic values of traditional cultures. And the reason I have that kind of confidence is that I think I've seen a new generation of Nigerians and Biafrans emerging. Men and women who have learned to value what is good and useful in their native traditions. People who have seen past the initial European disparagement of traditional forms, and who have recovered a respect for the way of life of their elders. These are the young people who have this kind of reverence for their own traditions, just as they desire the fruits of technological development for their people. And they're going to make the compromises. But it's they that are going to have to do it. And probably it's going to involve a lot of frustration and many failures on their parts. They're going to be very discouraged. And because of this, they need our goodwill and our practical support, but they need our goodwill and our practical support without any strings attached. Again, this business of being willing to accept what they produce. Because, after all, Nigeria and Biafra and Africa belong to them. Thank you very much.